HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/BIZ. This episode is brought to you by Eat Okra, your guide to Black-owned restaurants. Download the Eat Okra app on your smartphone today.
Welcome to another edition of Eat Your Heartland Out. I'm your host and tour guide, Capri Cafaro. Thanks for joining me as we explore the food of the American Midwest. Today's stop, Amish country. To tell us more about the Amish and Mennonite communities and their food, we are joined by Steve Nolte, Professor of History and Anabaptist Studies at Elizabethtown College. He is also a senior scholar at the college's Young Center for Anabaptist and Pietist Studies. I hope I got that right. Or Pietist Studies. I'll find out in a minute. And the author or co-author of 14 books on Amish and Mennonite history and culture. So he is a wealth of knowledge. Steve, we're happy to have you on the show.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
So I want to start out, Steve, if you could give our listeners a brief 101 course on who the Amish and Mennonites are for those that aren't familiar, and maybe what are some of the major differences between groups.
Sure. So these are Christian groups with roots in 16th century Europe. They were dissenters who broke with the state church system of the day, rejected infant baptism, emphasized the church as a separate pacifist people. That dissent made them quite unpopular with both the formally recognized state churches and with political and civic leaders of their day. So they were often persecuted and ended up in some cases living in kind of more remote rural parts of the Rhine Valley. There were some Mennonites who ended up living in more prosperous areas in the Netherlands and taking on a more urban life. But for the most part, these were more agriculturally centered peasant folks. The groups, as I said, as dissenters, they didn't have state church backing, and so that meant they were often very locally organized. They didn't have large, church structures or organizations or bureaucracies. And so groups developed differently in different places. And one leader named Jacob Ammon in the late 1600s, his community became associated with his name and became known as the Amish. And as I said, these are groups who understood the church as a separate people, a people who were kind of called by God out from mainstream society. But of course, the question is, well, what does separate mean? How separate is separate? And Jacob Ammon and the Amish tended to place more of an emphasis on separation, not necessarily seclusion or total self-sufficiency, but more of an emphasis on separation. And so we see this among the Amish today, dressing in very distinctive dress, use of horse and buggy transportation, limits on different technologies that they use, although the exact nature of those limits vary from one local community to another. Mennonites, on the other hand, are a bit more diverse. There would be some Mennonite communities that, to the casual observer, might appear very much like the Amish, people using horse and buggies and dressing very distinctively. But there are also many Mennonites whose day-to-day way of life, dress, appearance, level of education would be similar to that of other mainstream middle-class Americans. And so you would find Mennonite churches in Columbus, Ohio, or Cleveland, Ohio, or Detroit. You'd find Mennonite churches with African-American members and Latino members and so on. So there tends to be more diversity both in lifestyle and in location among Mennonites today. The Amish remain very much a rural people.
That's a very good Cliff Notes version of a very complex history of these groups that some are familiar with and many are not. Many have this just very generic idea of what an Amish is, don't even know Mennonites exist. So I appreciate you providing a little bit of context. This is not a history show. It's a food show, although it's a bit of food and history. So I would like to talk about how the Amish and Mennonite communities came to the Midwest and what kind of food traditions they brought with them.
Okay, so the first Amish and Mennonites coming to North America came to Pennsylvania, mostly in the 1700s, handful in the late 1600s. But they come to Pennsylvania in the 1700s. And then, like many other Europeans, descendants of European colonists, in the 1800s, some of their descendants begin moving westward. And so the first wave of Mennonites and Amish in the Midwest were descendants of those who had arrived in Pennsylvania in the 1700s and then start moving westward in the 1800s, settling in a band from basically Ohio to Iowa. And after about 1815, then there's a second wave of folks who are coming directly from Europe. There's another wave of migration in which Mennonites and Amish come from Europe. And in some cases, they arrive by ship in New Orleans and go up the Mississippi River to Illinois and Ohio. Others come to Baltimore and go further west. But in any case, they also settle from, again, mostly Ohio to Iowa in different communities. So, for example, in Ohio, in eastern Ohio, in Holmes County, Ohio, almost all of the Amish there are descendants of the Pennsylvania immigrants of the 1700s. If you go to Bern, Indiana, in Adams County, Indiana, the Amish folks there are almost all descendants of immigrants from the 1830s to the 1850s who came directly from Europe. So as you move around the Midwest, you find different migration histories. All of these folks are bringing with them probably their food ways from that they're either bringing from Europe or, in the case of those coming from Pennsylvania, something that would be sort of broadly understood as Pennsylvania German or often called Pennsylvania Dutch foodways. In Pennsylvania in the 1700s, Mennonites and Amish were a small minority of all of the German speakers in southeastern Pennsylvania. And so there was a fair bit of mixing and melding among not just Amish and Mennonite, but also German Lutheran and Reformed and Catholic folks, not necessarily religious mixing, but cultural mixing among those who shared the common language that is called Pennsylvania German or popularly called Pennsylvania Dutch. And so there's also that wider tradition that's represented by Mennonites and Amish who moved from Pennsylvania to the Midwest.
One group that I was unaware of, we often hear about, you know, the Pennsylvania Dutch, which are obviously, as you said, not Dutch. They are German. But I was really surprised to find out that there were Russian Mennonites in the Dakotas. This was something that never occurred to me. I knew nothing about it. And I'm sure that the listeners would love to hear more.
Yeah, so there's then this whole other story of Mennonites coming to North America that's quite different both geographically and in terms of time. In the 1870s, after the Civil War, about 18,000 Mennonites coming from what was then the Russian Empire settled in the U.S. Plain States and Canadian Prairie provinces, especially Manitoba, but Kansas through the Dakotas and Manitoba. There's the backstory to their migration to North America is a story of migration every several generations from the late 1500s on that had taken them first from the Netherlands to what's now Poland and then into what's now Ukraine. And at each of those places, they adopted or adapted new food ways from their neighbors, picked up some things, adapted some things, and carried that sort of rich and varied tradition from Northern Europe and Poland and Ukraine to North America. And so it's something that for a very much a migrant people. So like theologically, they believe they're a separate people as Mennonites. But in terms of this kind of perpetual migration, food was also one of the things that was very important in terms of their identity, both preserving their food traditions, but also adapting them and picking up different things along the way as they moved along.
How did they adapt to the Dakotas, for example, bringing all these different food ways from, what is now modern day Ukraine or Poland, and adapting them to the American Midwest and prairie states?
When the Mennonites arrive on the plains in the 1870s, one of the things that they brought with them and contributed to American agriculture was bringing what they called turkey red wheat or hard winter wheat, which other agricultural historians could talk more about how that revolutionized wheat growing in the Plain States. But that was one of the things that they brought with them from Ukraine that helped to transform agriculture and the kind of wheat and flour that many of us still eat today. They also continue their food traditions, and one of the ways even to this day in Freeman, South Dakota, there is an annual food festival in the spring that's called Schmeckfest. And people who grew up there and maybe haven't lived there for many years come back to participate, celebrate. It's sort of a community festival, but with a big emphasis on food. And so among the things that they make and eat would be farinica, which would be like a cottage cheese-filled dumpling served with meat gravy, certain kinds of breads, particularly zwieback. Plumamousse, which is like a fruit sauce, and a number of other things that continue to be very popular and well beloved in these communities.
I definitely have to take a pilgrimage out to the Dakotas for the Schmeckfest because I am infinitely curious. Particularly since in my corner of the Midwest, I am more familiar with Old Order Amish and their traditions in food as they live alongside of us, just 30 minutes away. They, at least in my experience, like many Amish and Mennonites, have some significant meals in their culture. And I know one of them is the post-church service dinner. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So the Amish worship in their, gather for worship and meet in members' homes. That is, they don't have church buildings, a few exceptions to that. But for the most part, the Amish don't build church buildings, but all the members of a particular church district, we in other traditions might call a congregation or a parish, but the local church, you all get together and meet in someone's home. And these worship services on Sunday mornings rotate from one home to another. So people take turns hosting church. There may be 150 to 175 people in your local church district, and maybe more if there are visitors from a neighboring Amish church district, for example. So you have a lot of people. They come to your house, or maybe you meet in the basement of your house, the first floor in a shop or a barn. And so in preparation for hosting, you'd move the furniture or whatever is in whatever space you're using and set up, arrange benches. And so every church district has a set of benches, a set of hymn books, and a set of plates, cups, coffee cups, cutlery for serving a meal. And so this is really the only property that an Amish church has. You don't have a building, you have benches and hymn books that move around, and then all this stuff for serving meals. Because when the church service is over, the church service lasts about 3 hours from roughly 9 to noon. When the church service concludes, everyone stays for a noon meal and actually stays all afternoon for informal visiting. And the benches are transformed into tables. There's a way in which they have metal hardware that can be kind of hooked together. And so benches can be set on top of one another and put together to make a table. And then other benches are pulled up next to them. And so you can quickly transform the space in which a lot of people have been sitting in close quarters into a series of long tables with benches on either side, spread tablecloths, and begin seating and serving food. Families don't sit as nuclear families. Rather, they eat in age and gender cohorts with the oldest people first. These meals are fairly simple meals. They're filling, but simple meals. And the meal is almost always the same. So as you're hosting church, it's a lot of work to host church and so and to provide the meal. So to ease that burden, the meal is relatively simple and always the same. So you know what to do. Helps with planning. And there's also no need to kind of compete or outdo anyone else with what you're serving because it's a set meal. From one community to another, the menu can vary a little bit, but it typically is a lot of homemade bread with spreads. One of the common bread spreads, and this surprises people sometimes because it seems not very traditional. But a common spread would be peanut butter that is mixed with marshmallow fluff, so it makes a sweet, light, very sort of spreadable peanut butter spread on homemade bread. There are also lunch meats and cheeses, pickles, pickled vegetables of different kinds, often bowls of pretzels, usually pie for dessert, a variety of pies, and coffee. So it's a cold meal again in most places. Fairly simple, but there's always lots of food, and so it can be pretty filling. People sit around and spend the rest of the afternoon visiting.
That sounds like quite a production, even if it is a cold meal. There's one other significant meal I do want to touch on before I let you go, and that is the fundraising dinner. That's something that I've had an opportunity to attend Amish fundraising dinners in Northeastern Ohio. I know they vary from community to community, but I think it's an important story to be told of why Amish communities do these fundraising dinners and what is served there.
Yeah. So one of the ways that Amish churches understand the church as your primary community is that Amish church members, as a rule, don't participate in wider commercial or public insurance programs. So when there are health costs and so on, rather than relying on commercial insurance companies or relying on the government, they believe it's important to rely on one's neighbors and church for bearing those costs. And so their free will offering system helps to defer a lot of medical costs, but there are also medical bills nowadays, and of course some in the past that are quite extraordinary. And they've turned to a number of fundraising, social celebratory events that also raise money for paying for extraordinary medical expenses. And again, despite the fact that they're interested in having the church as the primary community, which they are, these meals are also open to others, open to neighbors. So if you've experienced one of these, that it was not an exclusively Amish event. So a lot of other non-Amish neighbors may attend as well. And so these meals are also times of fellowship and conversation with neighbors, and you know, again, what is served, again, is going to vary a little bit from place to place. In northern Indiana, where I lived for about 23 years, one of the very common fundraising meals was called a haystack dinner. And it would be, you would start with an empty plate and move down a table with, you know, sort of all the ingredients, and you'd build your meal. And I guess that was the idea of the haystack language, but usually begin with corn chips, and then this might surprise you next, but hot white rice. And then there would be lettuce and tomatoes and onions, almost maybe like you were making a taco salad. There would be some cases meat sauce on top, in other cases maybe more of just a taco sauce. So it was a large. Some people would look at it and say, "Yeah, it's sort of like a version of a taco salad," but it had the white rice there as one of the base ingredients. But you'd end up with at the end of the table with a large plate of food, and then there would be various drinks, whether lemonade or coffee, and then usually a lot of good desserts as well.
Always. Pie and desserts are always something that at least I have consistently associated with the Amish community. I've never experienced a haystack dinner, even though I have been to some of these fundraisers in my area. So that shows just the differences regionally across Amish foodways in the Midwest. Steve Nolte, thank you so very much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We'll be right back after a short break.
This episode is brought to you by Eat Okra, your guide to Black-owned restaurants. If you'd like to support local Black-owned businesses, or maybe just find a new favorite place to eat, download the Eat Okra app now. Whatever city you find yourself in, Eat Okra will connect you to hundreds of Black-owned restaurants, bakeries, cafes, food trucks, bars, and wine shops. Download the Eat Okra app on your smartphone today to get started.
Our next guest is going to bring us further into the Amish kitchen and important Amish celebration meals. Karen Johnson Weiner is a distinguished service professor of anthropology emerita at SUNY Potsdam in Potsdam, New York. She has written a number of books on Amish culture, including a new book called The Lives of Amish Women from Johns Hopkins University Press. Karen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
Well, I love this topic, and I've said this throughout this episode. Growing up in Northeastern Ohio, I have grown up alongside of Amish communities. And so I've always had a great deal of interest in Amish and Mennonite foodways and their celebrations. And that's one of the things we're talking about today, as well as how Amish food and the Amish kitchen has evolved or not evolved. And I'd like to start there. And since you have written a book about the lives of Amish women, I thought you would be a good person to talk about how the Amish kitchen has changed through the years, particularly when it comes to things like food preparation and that sort of thing, as it varies across the different types of Amish and Mennonite communities.
Well, kitchens have changed a lot simply because the Amish have changed a lot. And so, you know, for example, as you move from a wood fired stove to do your meal prep into, you know, using a gas stove, or as you go from having all of your foods canned or preserved at home to having refrigerator freezers, your food preparation naturally changes. If you look at the most conservative Amish, you know, who are producing much of their own food, not all of it. They're not shopping for very much. They're making all of their own bread still. They're preserving their vegetables. They're preserving their fruit by canning it. They're preserving their meat by butchering it themselves and salting or smoking or canning it. And that's quite different if you move, you know, if you were to go into a kitchen in the most progressive Amish community, where there would be a freezer. And because there's more disposable income, the family is entrepreneurial, or members work for wage labor outside of the home, there's more disposable income. And so they can be purchasing foods. They can purchase much more than of what they're using than the most conservative. They're not doing nearly so much canning. They're not doing their own butchering anymore. And so meals will simply vary quite a bit more, because the kitchens in which they're being prepared are different, and the circumstances of those preparing them are different.
Right. And I want to stick on this, because I think that it's an important cultural distinction, and it has, a specific impact on family dynamics. So you talked a little bit about how there are some Amish families that maybe are more entrepreneurial, or maybe a bit more liberalized, so to speak. I've seen this again in some of the communities around me, where you see Amish teens behind the counter at a local fast food place or at Mary Yoder's Amish Kitchen in the bakery. So you see these folks being able to earn outside of the traditional, outside of the home and some of the traditional activities, meaning they have more disposable income, maybe meaning that they're spending less time doing food prep and preservation. So how does that impact the family dynamics and the passing down of food traditions when families may not be spending the same kind of time doing those kind of food-related activities?
It has an enormous impact. In the most conservative communities, food preparation is very much a communal effort. You've got, you know, everyone, the little children pressed into service to bring wood in, to feed the fire in the wood stove. You've got, you know, mothers and daughters working together to prepare everything. And so daughters are learning from their mothers how to cook, how to prepare the same meals their mothers did. And what you find then is that meals, as you move from, say, one very conservative household to another in the same community, they're going to be the same. And daughters are learning the same kinds of cooking. And, you know, when a couple gets married, husbands and wives have expectations about what they're going to eat. And they're going to be the same as both of them separately grew up with, because they grew up doing the same things in the same kind of household. When you reach, or when you go into communities in which, the wife, the mother, maybe she has a job, so she's working outside the home. When the father is working outside the home or working in his own business, and the mother has her own business, they're not spending nearly as much time doing food prep. Daughters aren't working so much with mothers to learn food prep. They don't need to do as much food prep, because more of their of what they're eating is being purchased and not preserved at home. Food preparation becomes a much more individualistic kind of event, and you don't have young girls growing up to do things exactly like their mothers did in the same way. And so you also have more variation than, a couple gets married. They may come from homes where meals were completely different, because the circumstances under which they were prepared were different.
Give me some examples of that variation. So if you are in a home that may have this more consistent meal prep, where mothers are handing those food traditions down to daughters, what you may see and being eaten in that household versus maybe one of these other communities where people are working outside of the home. And as you said, it's a more individualistic experience in food preparation and eating. What are those differences?
Well, for example, in a very conservative home, everybody's butchering at the same time. So you're having the same kinds of meats. You're having the same kinds of preparation of meat to preserve it, which means that when that meat is served, you're pretty much having the same meals. You know, people are making their chicken the same way. People are making the same kinds of pies, because they've all preserved the same fruits that have come in. And they've learned to make those pies in particular ways. So I can go to one very conservative home and be offered an apple pie, and that filling's going to be made in exactly the same way as at the next home where I'm offered a piece of apple pie. And I'm not saying that all cooks are equally good. The two apple pies might not taste, one might not be as tasty as the other, but the filling's going to look exactly the same, and the dough's going to be rolled out exactly the same. And it's because they've all learned to make the same kinds of things in the same way. So, you know, I can expect that I can get, I'm not going to get a cold cut sandwich at a conservative home. They're going to be a home cooked meal, and it's because mom's home and the daughters are home and everybody's preparing it together. And I can have pretty much the same meal at any conservative home in the same community that I go to. If I'm in a very progressive community, mothers have shopped for much of what they may be serving. They maybe learn to prepare it in different ways. You may be relying on, you know, whatever happened to be in the refrigerator that day. They're not the same kinds of expectations for what you will find when you go into a more progressive home.
I'm just fascinated by these differences, and I'm curious to know, you mentioned a little bit earlier in our conversation about when couples get married, they bring in certain expectations from their upbringing, which is, you know, customary across pretty much all cultures. But because there seems to be variations between more traditional Amish food ways versus those that might be more liberalized and have more choices, I'm curious to learn more about something that is, I think, a celebratory icon in Amish tradition, and that is the Amish wedding dinner. I want to learn more about what gets served at these Amish wedding dinners and variations that may occur across the culture as well. Just as we've been talking about the day-to-day differences, what are those differences in the context of an Amish wedding dinner? So first, let's set the stage. If we were at an Amish wedding meal, what would we see, smell, and taste?
Well, it would depend on what kind of church community you were in. I've been to very conservative Schwartz and Trooper weddings, and there the meal is a kind of, it's chicken. Often it's chicken that's been canned, so it's been cooked in advance, or even if it's bought in advance, it's going to be rolled in butter, rolled in crumbs, layered and baked. And I have to tell you, it's the best chicken in the world. And you're going to have that with mashed potatoes. You're going to have fruit and bowls. You're going to start your meal with bread and slices of cheese, and there will be fruit and, you know, a salad, mashed potatoes, gravy, noodles, and this chicken. And every single wedding that you go to in that community will have exactly the same menu. And you will have exactly the same kinds of cakes served at the supper. And you will have exactly the same kinds of pies served after the main meal following church. If you go to other communities, you may, different communities will have their own traditions. So in Lancaster County, you're going to get a chicken roast. And you can count on there being mashed potatoes and gravy, bread with different spreads, something they call an Indiana salad, which is green jello with pineapples and cream and Cool Whip mixed in, which is you'd never see at a Schwartz and Trooper wedding. But then I've also been to a wedding where they served barbecued chicken. Now, the commonality in all of those things is chickens, which is why the Schwartz and Troopers call weddings Hingelfleisch Frolic, a party where you eat chicken. A frolic is a work party. And so your work is eating chicken. But each community would have its own. There would be, again, a bit more variation, a bit more independence going into the menu the more progressive you are than in the more conservative.
There's something else that I have heard about that maybe you can talk a little bit more about, and that is something called a wedding trailer that apparently pops up at some of the more liberal, so to speak, Amish wedding celebrations.
Mm-hmm. A wedding trailer, it's an older feature out in say northern Indiana. Basically, a wedding trailer is like a traveling kitchen with freezer facilities. It comes with dishes. In the most conservative communities, when you're going to have a wedding, well, nobody has that many dishes, so you end up borrowing dishes from your neighbors, from extended family members, to have enough plates, to have enough pots and pans to cook with, to have enough glasses, and so on. Some groups have started using paper plates, but you know, most want to have real dishes. The wedding trailer supplies that. You rent it in advance. It comes with dishes, glasses, silverware, the whole shebang. You can cook in it, which is important because, you know, it just expands the facilities for preparing the meal. And in more progressive communities, as weddings have gotten bigger and bigger and bigger because people have more disposable income, they can travel more easily, and so on, you need more facilities to cook more meals. It's been a feature in some of the Midwestern communities longer. It's now moving into Lancaster County. I think there are some in Ohio among the more liberal. In Lancaster County, it's replacing, they used to have chests you could rent, and the chests would be full of dishes and so on. And the wedding trailer is now replacing that. And it means something else too. It means that you have to start planning for the wedding long before it's actually time for the wedding, because you have to rent the trailer. And that means if you know when the date's going to be, you can make sure you have that wedding trailer. And that's another change, because traditionally nobody knew you were going to have a wedding until the couple was published in church. And now if you're renting the wedding trailer months in advance, people are going to know. So it's an innovation that speaks to basically people no longer doing the weddings all themselves at home with just the community.
Well, that's a great place for us to end our conversation, because I think it's just so interesting to hear about how there's evolution even in a community like the Amish and the Mennonite, where I think most of us from outside of those communities see Amish and Mennonites, Amish in particular, old order Amish, as stagnant, as stuck in the past, as just very traditional, whether it is their food ways or their just general way of life. And what you are telling us is from the kitchen to the wedding celebration, there is still variation and evolution, even in some of the most traditional communities in the Midwest. So I appreciate your willingness to share your expertise, Karen. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Eat Your Heartland Out is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.